Hi, everybody. This is a special bonus episode. We thought we'd take the audio from the live stream that we did on the YouTube channel and put it up as a bonus. We won't, it seems, manage an episode of the normal podcast for February. A few things happened that derailed us a bit, so we wanted to give you this instead. One thing, however, the audio isn't amazing. We didn't use the same microphone, and it's not great. So, apologies for that. It's completely understandable, it just doesn't sound great. So, this is questions and answers, or questions we were asked by people watching the live stream, people who had set stuff in ahead of time, and I think it's interesting information, and I hope you find it enjoyable. But we will be back with a new episode in March, I promise. And in the meantime, thanks for listening.
There we go. And I believe we are live. Hello, everyone. I apologize right away for the quality of my voice because I have a cold and I feel like my head is a block of stuff that is gooey. Mm. I won't say the word because it's a nicky word.
Yeah, we've both been fighting off a cold over the past week and have also been talking all week due to the Lincoln conference.
Mm-hmm.
So our voices are a little strained.
A little rough. But welcome to the Alliterative Endless Knot Lingfest Q&A live stream. Is that everything?
Yeah.
Say hi in the chat if you're here and you want to say hi. We'll probably give it a moment for people to tune in before we get really started, and I'm going to drink my ginger and lemon tea. I know I promised cocktails, but I'm not up for cocktails right now.
I have a Tom Collins, so it's a cocktail, but you know, it's a tall drink. It's largely just soda water. So.
Might be possibly because it's only 1 p.m. here, so it's a bit early for the cocktails.
Soda water and lemon juice, so it's probably good for my lots of vitamin C. So.
Exactly.
And some old Tom gin, of course.
Of course. So what we're going to be doing, we have some questions that people asked us already, and we're going to start off by answering some of those. But if you have other questions that you want to ask, pop them in the chat. If you just want to say hi, if you have any follow-ups to whatever we discuss, this is just it's an opportunity to chat about and nerd about out about anything that we have any expertise on and some things that we don't have much expertise about. So we had a good suggestion for starting off, which was from Rayan Khan, maybe 343 on YouTube. Anyway, a question which said we should start by introducing ourselves and talking about the origins of our names, which is a good idea. So we'll start with that. So Mark, do you want to say your name and explain where it's from?
Well, my first name is a well-known etymology. So Mark, from the Roman name Marcus, which, you know, common wisdom holds that it is connected to the god Mars, and that seems like probably true. But the complication comes in, you know, in terms of where the god name Mars comes from. So we think of Mars as the god war, the Roman god of war, who became sort of associated with the Greek Ares. But originally, Mars was not a god of war, it seems. He may have been originally a god of thunder. In any case, the name seems to come from some pre-Roman god. It could be an Etruscan god. So of course, the Etruscans were, you know, a powerhouse in the region of Italy before the rise of Roman power, Roman influence.
And whenever there's a word in Latin that we don't know the origins of, or a word or anything to do with religion, immediately they say, oh, it's probably Etruscan. It's a good get out of jail free card because we don't actually know Etruscan. We only know a few words of it, and we don't know much about it, and it's not Proto-Indo-European, so it's an easy out. Oh, it's probably Etruscan. Yeah, can't go past that.
So there was an Etruscan god, Mars, so it could be from that god. As I said, originally Mars himself seems to come from an Indo-European god, from the same god that also produced Thor, the Norse god Thor. And so things got kind of shifted around in terms of the associations and so forth. Another possibility is that Mars, the name, comes from the stem mawort. Again, we don't really know where it comes from, but there is an earlier form, mawors, related to the Oscan. Oscan is another Italic language related to Latin, so Oscan mammers. So, I mean, we can sort of piece together what the name sort of sounded like, what it might have been before, but it's all very uncertain.
Yeah, and it's important to say also that Mars, the god, might have been a god of thunder, but also seems to have been a god of agriculture, or at least most of his early rites at Rome are actually to do with agricultural and spring planting. And that's why March is the god Mars's month, which is a spring month. It also then becomes, the thinking goes, though, it's not, none of this is more than speculation, frankly, but the thinking goes that because March was also the month in which the campaigning season began, that's when, because in the ancient world, or in certainly early Rome, fighting was a cyclical thing. You did it, you went in the spring, you fought over the summer, and you came back in time for harvest. And so it's because it was the beginning of the spring campaign season, over time, March became associated with the beginnings of going out to war. And so Mars, as the god of that time, became associated with war. And but all of this happens before we have written records, so it's hard to tell. But there's traces definitely of him as an agricultural and fertility god in Roman ritual. So that does seem to be likely. Yep.
So the next part then is my last name. So Sundaram, it's an Indian name, and it comes from the word Sunara or Sunaram, so which means glad, joyous, delightful. And that D gets added in. It has nothing to do with the etymology. So Sunar becomes Sundar. It's just an intrusive letter, as linguists term these things.
It seems to make it sound very rude, but it's for ease of speech, right? Like, because it's easier to say and it makes this clearer, the syllables clearer.
So this is a, you know, from Hindi, from Sanskrit. This is an Indo-European root. And so that sun part, the first part of that word, comes from esu, which means good. And it is actually an extension of an even simpler, more basic Indo-European root, es, which is the verb to be. So, I mean, that's where we get the word is from. So to be and then to be good is the sort of progression of that. The second part of that word, Nara, comes from the, well, it means man, and it comes from the Proto-Indo-European root ner, meaning man, in its most basic sense. It probably had something like vigorous, vital, strong, the kind of qualities associated with masculinity. And from that root, that's related to, for instance, the andro, all those andro words.
Androgyny. That's a weird one to cite. It's both androcentric. Yeah. Actually, that's a good place to pause, because there was a question, or Swedish Finn Polymath, who turns out is named Marcus, brought up, you asked about, you mentioned Alexander, and that's a good place to stick that in, because that ander on Alexander is that word, andros, aner, andros. So in Greek, so it's Alexander is from Greek, and the word for man that comes from this root in Greek is aner in the nominative, and the stem is andra. So in all the other cases, it's andra, so aner, andros. And that in Alexander, the Alex is warding off or protecting. So Alexandros is the warder off, the protector of man, either a man who protects or someone who protects men. So it can work either way. And so you get, it is a very common word name in Greek. So Paris, for instance, in the Trojan War, his other name, in fact, the name by which he's called most often in the Iliad is Alexandra, because he's the man who, you know, protects the city. Obviously, it's basically an ironic name, as many names in myth are, because he is the one who brings the downfall of the city. He's the destroyer of the city. His birth is presaged by a dream that his mother has, that she gives birth to a torch that burns down the city. So him being called Alexandros could be called sort of an effort to ward off what his birth, the omen of his birth. So anyway, so Alexander, but we know Alexander, and the reason it becomes such a hugely widespread name in the modern world is, of course, Alexander the Great, who was notable as really the opposite of a protector of men. He was a destroyer of many, many men, but I suppose he may have decided that he was protecting some of them. Anyway, so that's connected to, there's the, and there is same root as in Una. Mm-hmm. Nara.
So Su and Nair, or Sunar, means literally, you know, good man.
Right. So you're warlike good man? I say nothing. Hi, Organic 1971. All right, so that's Mark's name, and my name is Avon McMaster. I'm less visible on the well, my head is so full
the
of
video
goo.
Side of things.
The video side of things, thank you. This is a bad omen. Though if you listen to the podcast, you're used to me. And my name is a little bit odd in that my first name, Avon, is not typically a name. There are more people now with the first name Avon. It's starting to grow, but I mean, it's extremely rare. So I'll tell you the origin of where it comes from as a name for me, and then a bit about what the, in as much as there is a source for the name. I'm named after the mountain avens, which is a flower that grows in the Rockies, elsewhere as well, but in the Rockies, my parents used to go hiking there, and they liked the flower, and my mom had a dream about them anyway, and my parents were hippies in the 70s, so they named me after a flower, and so that my name is Avon, without the S on the end. So that's what I'm named after. That flower is, the Latin name is the Dryas octopetala. So it's from the dryad family, Dryas family, which is named after the dryads from Greek myth. And the octopetala just means it has eight petals. Excuse me. As I said, vaguely. The name Avon's, it's hard to say because the name of a flower is not etymologized as much as some others, but it's just a common name, but it probably comes from the Celtic root ab, which means water or river. So it's probably cognate, unsurprisingly, to the word Avon, like the river in Stratford-upon-Avon. And there's some other Celtic, there's a fair number of Celtic water words that have that ab or av prefix. There's also a word in French, aven, which is a cave formed, the kind of pothole cave that's formed by water seeping down and causing sort of undercutting the ground so that you get these sort of direct, the kind of caves that you would drop into rather than climb into. And that's an aven, and it seems to be associated with that, the Celtic word. So that's as close as I can get to an origin for that name. But my last name, McMaster, is pretty straightforward. Mick is the patronymic prefix. Mick or Mac, those are just two spellings of the same one. They come from the Celtic word ma, or the root macos, which is sun. So it's just very literally sun, and as in son of the father. That word you see in the Welsh, you get map, so you, and app, so you'll find in Welsh names, you'll find app or map as a prefix or as a separable prefix that's used to denote the same thing. And it performs the same, it has the same as the O in like O'Leary or something like that, where it is of, just from, which again is a patronymic. And there's patronymics, you get this kind of thing in what is it, what's the Russian patronymic, a Vich, the suffix Vich, like Petrovich is just son of Peter. So that is a name that, a name formation, a last name formation that comes from the period when people were still just saying so-and-so son of so-and-so. And then it at some point becomes fixed as a name. And master, so it means son of the master. And master in that context almost certainly means teacher. Master comes from the Latin magister, which is the same word that gives us magistrate. So in general, it just means bigger one, one with more power, because it's from the adjective from magus, which is the adjective or adverb more, the comparative form of we get magus and maxima, so that the comparative and the superlative. And they come from the root, the Proto-Indo-European root meg, which just means great, big. So magus means bigger or greater, and the, or more. And magister is one with more power, one who's in front, one who's the leader. We get magistrate from it, but it also was the term that was used to mean a teacher, especially in the Middle Ages, so it becomes this sort of standard term for teacher. It's what gives us the master's degree, you know, becoming a master of something.
Or schoolmaster.
A schoolmaster, all of those. The form master is somewhat influenced by maître, or what becomes the French maître, which is the same word that comes from the same root, but developed slightly differently in pronunciation, and so it then influenced the English form of the word to help the G drop out and have it become master. So McMaster means son of the teacher. And then, so at some point in the past, some family member was a teacher and then somebody else got that name. But it, as you, I'm sure, know, McMaster is a very common name and it's all over the place. Ironically, I am the child of a teacher. My father was a teacher, a college teacher. And also, ironically, also, McMaster is definitely a Scottish name, but, and my father is Scottish, was born in Scotland, but his father was born in Plymouth and was English. So the McMaster actually comes from the English side of the family, while my grandmother's name is an extremely common English name, even though she was Scottish and born in Scotland. So, you know, everyone's like, oh, McMaster, that must be because you're Scottish. And I'm like, yes, but also no, because that's not where that name came from, but that's okay. So anyway, so that's mine. I'm watery child of the teacher, I guess. A watery flower child of the teacher. Oh, thank you, Topher. I very much appreciate that. That is extremely kind. Mark, do you want to answer Topher's question? Topher has opinions on this question, while mm-hmm. I make a note of Robert's question to come back to.
Right. Okay, so Topher says, enjoy the 12 days of Christmas videos. How does your production process differ from your short form versus long form content? So there's the very technical side of the way we film it. The short form content is all directly to camera, whereas the long form content, we always have a little introduction directly to camera. But in terms of how it's produced, I record just an audio only voiceover for the majority of the video and then animate to produce the visuals, whereas the short form, since it's done directly to camera, we've experimented with a few different ways of how to get that, but what we've settled on is kind of the same way that we record the little intros to, you know, to the longer videos. So it's done to camera with an iPad serving as a teleprompter.
And I think the other piece is that they're both scripted, obviously, and we've been written before. The short ones come, we're drawing them from the etymologies that Mark has been doing as tweets for a few years now. So we've been drawing them. So they're already written there. Then we just put them, you know, edit them so that they're going to come in at under a minute, because right now that's the like limitation on a short. And then just, you know, do them straight. They are just etymologies, as you know, with very occasionally an extra fact. Those are very easy comparatively to produce, right? Mark just has to, they come about originally because you come up, mostly you just think of one, either you see an interesting pair or you think of one word and then find some interesting related word that is surprising and write it from there. So we've got a whole backlog of those. The reason we started doing them is because they're very quick to do. They're already written. We edit them briefly. We record in a batch and then I do them on my phone and put in the words, the actual visuals in them. I know it's extremely bare bones and not very cool, but then I'm not very cool and not very good at it. So that's as good as I can get. The contrast to that is the long videos, which take a lot of work, as evidenced by the fact we did not manage a long video last year, which is a first and not something we're particularly proud of.
We got some in-between length ones.
Yeah, we got some shorter ones, but none of the big ones, because those ones take a huge amount of research and then writing and then rewriting and editing and then finding all the images and then animating them, well, putting it into the big sort of one document that has, or the one thing, that image that has all of those images in, putting in all the writing, animating that, doing the voiceover, cutting the voiceover to editing it to the appropriate, so the, and all the mistakes out, then matching those, editing the videos so that it matches to the audio, and then putting that out. And that is a huge thing. And due to life, essentially, we just haven't, you haven't really got past the research. You're just into the writing finally on the thing you've been working on for.
Yeah, about a third of the way into this, to a script.
Yeah, so there is a script that he's been working on since last Christmas, and that you could say what it is. I think.
It's another in the series of cocktail etymology.
Yeah. So it's going to be another cocktail, but it just takes a long time to do the research. And these days, Mark finds so much interesting research that then the more interesting research he finds, the longer the script, the longer all the other pieces of the process are. And so we started doing the shorts partly because YouTube is really pushing shorts, but also because it felt really bad not to be putting out material, but there was really they don't really delay the production of the longer one because Mark doesn't have to write research or write anything new. It just takes half an hour to do a batch of filming, and then I do the production on it, and I can't do anything to help him with the other video until he gets further with it anyway. So it doesn't, it's not that we are doing the shorts now and that's why we're not doing the longer one, because we haven't got a longer one out, we're doing the shorts. Is the way it's working.
Oh, and specifically for the 12 Days of Christmas shorts, though, those came, they're sort of excerpted and modified from a longer video that we did ages and ages ago. So that's where those specifically come from.
Yeah. Yeah. And we may do some other themed ones like that around other events or something if they come up. Next time the Olympics are up, we have a whole bunch of Olympics ones, for instance. But there's no Olympics right now, so we can't do this. So thank you very much for your contribution and your question. Robert, I don't know the answer to that question. I dutifully just wrote it down, but I don't actually know. What's hell? Are Asian names like European names and having professional titles in them?
I can speak a little bit about South Asian traditions. I don't know how much of a role professional names play into it, but it is a patronym. So your last name, which is actually your first name. The family name is derived from your father's name.
Right.
And so with every generation, that family name changes. It's, of course, now been interrupted in my case. So my last name is indeed from my father's given name, but I have now passed down my last name to my children as their last name. So
yeah, and your father really was the one who started that by taking, you know, westernizing his name when he immigrated to England, actually, and taking the name that came second in the way that it was written in his own culture and language, and saying, okay, well, we'll just call that my second name, my last name, and then sort of the nickname or the name of his became his first name, and that was a name we knew him by, but his family still all called him by what we call his last name.
Yeah.
And that was his first name. It was confusing. But now it's just been fossilized as last name.
Yeah.
So that won't happen anymore. But So, and I don't know about professional names in other cultures, unfortunately.
No.
I don't know how that works. If anyone in the comments does, I'd be interested to know. Oh, goodness. Again, apologies for the voices and the hearty amount of cold that is coming through.
Fortunately, you can't catch cold through.
We are all still socially distanced. It's very good. And it's not COVID. I've tested multiple times. It's just a cold that the entire family is in. All right. Well, as I said, if you have any other questions, please do keep putting them in the chat. But we will go back to one of the other questions that was asked. This one comes from a Patreon subscriber, Daniel Hoppersberger.
Dariel,
sorry. Of course, I knew that. I just can't see that far away. And this is a multi-part question that I might not, I don't know, do you want to read out the whole question or do you want to just answer it and explain it? It's a question about how the early Old English and Scandinavian languages interacted and how that affected English's simplification of grammar, in particular with reference to gender, grammatical gender.
Right.
So do you want to?
So, well, he starts off with, you know, kind of reviewing the sort of common wisdom in terms of how grammatical gender disappeared from English, basically because the Old English and Old Norse are both Germanic languages, so they're fairly similar. They've got the same basic vocabulary in terms of the roots of the words, but the endings are all different. So they found, because of heavy Scandinavian settlement, particularly in the north of England, there was a lot of intermixing of populations, intermarriage, and so forth. And so they found it was easier to communicate if they just stopped paying attention to the endings and just used the roots of the words to communicate, because those were pretty similar. And therefore, the endings kind of disappeared from the language because no one was using them anymore. And as a result of that, since there were no endings left, there was nothing to clearly indicate grammatical gender. And so once you have nothing indicating it, you kind of forget. That is exactly, you know, how it happened. You know, it was, Old English was already, you know, gradually losing those inflections, those endings anyways, but the arrival of Norse on the scene really accelerated that process. And, you know, that did lead to the disappearance of grammatical gender. So that's absolutely true.
Daniel goes on to ask about how much Old English and Old Norse differed in what gender various words were. Well, like, did they have different genders for the same word? Is that one of the reasons it was complex? Or were they the same gender but different endings?
Yeah, so it's the second of those. So they generally agreed in gender because those words are coming from the same Proto-Germanic stock of vocabulary. And so unless there was something, some reason for the gender of a word to flip or something as it, you know, developed over time, you know, they're going to be the same gender most of the time. I'm not going to say that there were no differences. There probably were a few differences that crept in here and there. But, you know, for the most part, they have this, you know, the same word had the same gender in the two languages. But what was really different is what the endings looked like. And so just to kind of demonstrate this, I'm going to tell you the forms of an Old English and Old Norse word, or the two sort of cognate words, the word stone, which in Old English was, and in Old Norse was stain. Now, in Old English, there's no ending. It's just S-T-A-N. In Old Norse, in the, and this is the nominative singular form, as it were, it's S-T-I-N, and then another N is the ending. Now, they sound pretty similar, so that wouldn't have caused too much difficulty. Then in the accusative singular, they would have both been the same, no ending. So just ston or stain, single N there. The genitive also looks pretty similar. So in Old English, it's stanes with an ES ending, whereas in Old Norse, it's stains with an S ending. So pretty similar. Then it gets a little more different in what's called the dative singular form. So in Old English, it's stane with an E, and in Old Norse, it's staini with an I. They don't look radically different, but it is a different ending. Then it gets even more different when you get to the plurals. So in Old English, the nominative and accusative plurals end in AS, stanas, for both the nominative and the accusative plural. And indeed, that's where our modern English plural S comes from. It comes from this AS ending, the A kind of just disappeared, and we're just left with the S in modern English. Now, in Old Norse, the nominative plural is stanar, A-R, so that's quite a bit different. And then in Old Norse, the accusative plural has a different ending. So, you know, as I said, it's AS for both the nominative and accusative plural in Old English. In Old Norse, the plural and the accusative plural are different. So whereas it's stinar in the nominative, it's stina in the accusative plural.
Is everyone keeping up with this?
Yeah.
Without having it written out in front of you, like I've got it written out and I still can't follow it. But obviously the important point here is that there are differences. No quizzes. We don't have a quiz at the end. Go on, sorry.
Well, and then the rest of the plurals, they actually are the same. The ending is A for both and stain Norse.
Right.
So, I mean, and this is one of the ones where they're relatively similar, but you'll see that there are some key differences that could lead to confusion, especially when you get an ending that means, that looks identical, but means a different thing in the other language. That can cause a lot of confusion. And it's almost worse having the endings similar, but not the same. You know, anyone who has, you know, been trying to learn a second language can probably attest to that. You know, the problems when you have two things in your two languages that are similar but not quite the same, and you get them confused all the time. So, and that's just one example of one paradigm. Across all the different grammatical forms, there's all kinds of, you know, little differences and things here and there. So, you know, it led to, you know, confusion, and so hence the dropping of those endings and the loss of grammatical gender. And once you drop the endings, you know, there isn't an easy way to tell gender unless you include another word that agrees with the noun. So originally you would have the definite article, or you would have
an article of some sort
that would have endings that could tell you, you know, what form of the noun you're dealing with. Though in Old English, originally you didn't have to include an article. It was optional. And in fact, what becomes modern English's definite article, the, originally meant, it had a little more force than that. It meant really that. And so you don't go around saying that stone all the time, right? You know, unless you're trying to call attention to it, you just say the stone. So, you know, it wasn't required early on in Old English. It gradually becomes required as Old English becomes early Middle English, and it becomes more like our definite article. But by that point, the definite article forms were becoming less and less distinct, and to till the point where now you use the for everything, right? Yeah. You use just the one form and it doesn't tell you anything. So you can't rely on that for help.
Yeah, and once you start to substantially not have indicators of what gender things are, then you aren't, you know, your next generation isn't learning them as gendered nouns. Mm-hmm. And once you aren't learning them as gendered nouns, they no longer have gender. You know, because it only has gender as long as there's a need to, as long as there's a requirement in the language to indicate that gender. So as soon as that's gone, it's gone.
And just as a little footnote to that, you use the example milk. Those happen to both be feminine. I checked just to see. So yeah, Old English milk and old, so they're both feminine forms in the languages.
And then another question was, did Old English and Old Norse have two grammatical genders or three, like modern German does today?
So Proto-Germanic had three, masculine, feminine, and neuter. English, you know, and so those three, you know, survived into Old English, and eventually by modern English, gender is lost completely. In Swedish and Danish, so Old Norse had all three, like modern German. But in Sweden and Danish, the masculine and feminine genders merged into what's called the common gender. So that's the gender for human beings, for living. It's sort of animate, inanimate in the sense. So masculine and feminine merged into common gender, but they kept the neuter. And so Swedish and Danish have two genders, and modern Icelandic, the three, masculine, feminine, and neuter.
And then did the influence of French on English in Middle English, did that affect genders? Yeah.
Yeah.
Did Middle English have grammatical gender?
Yeah. So that certainly was, you know, helpful that it was already on the way out by the time French started to have an influence. With that system of grammatical gender was already beginning to break down. And so, yeah, that made it easy for the French words just to come in, and you don't have to think about grammatical gender because they weren't really paying that close attention to it anymore anyways.
And by that point, English and French do differ on the gender of most nouns.
They do.
Oh, not most.
Not most, but many.
Many. Like there's no particular pattern to which ones have what gender. Like yeah. There's no real common reason that they would have the same gender. So they do or don't in a kind of random way. So that would have just hastened that.
Like sun process. And moon in French is masculine. La lune is feminine, but it's the reverse in Old English. Mm-hmm. In Old English, sun is feminine and moon is masculine.
Yeah, so that would have happened. And so they basically, I mean, there were genders in early Middle English, but not by late Middle English, basically. Like that was the end of it.
Yeah, yeah. So those three genders just survive into Middle English, into early Middle English. You can still see, you know, text preserving that, but there at that point there's very few places where, you know, it's really distinctly shown, and so it disappears pretty quickly after that. So by the time you get any significant amount of Middle English being written, it sort of reemerges as a literary language in, you know, in the 14th century. By then, you know, the grammatical gender is gone. So we've got
except
in pronouns.
Yeah.
Yeah. But for now. And well, what happens is grammatical gender gives way to natural gender. It's right. Really what happens there.
Right, because we still have actor, actress, and you know, things like that. So nouns can be gendered by changing their endings. Director, directrix. I mean, we not that that's a very common one, but there are these different ways. But only when we only do that now when we're matching up the natural gender of the person mm-hmm. described. As opposed to grammatical gender, which obviously, since it applies to inanimate things, is not about genitalia, essentially. Sorry. Excuse me, sorry. I wanted to just say to Topher Hasmanian, just for the record, we prefer the long, I mean, the short stuff is fine too. We are not in any way stopping doing the longer form stuff. We do want to do more of it. We would like to get this one done and then, like, get another one done this year. Yep. You know, we enjoy it as well. That is the core of what we want to be doing. The other place, of course, if you're interested in podcasts, if you don't already listen to our podcast, not that it's the same, but it is long. So if you want long form stuff, it's an hour to an hour and a half usually.
But there definitely will be some more longer videos coming out this year. So one hopefully fairly soon, as I say, I'm well on the way to writing that script. So.
And then there's another question. Do you have an opinion on if English had developed differently if the Normans hadn't won in 1066? and maybe I guess what it might have done. That's a bit of a big what if, but
yeah, I mean, yeah, it's hard to say. I don't think it would have made an enormous amount of historical difference. It would obviously be a huge linguistic difference. So the language would have, you know, been more like the other Germanic languages. It would have been, you know, fairly close to languages like Dutch.
Dutch and Frisian, right, are the, mm-hmm. the closest ones on the continent. Yeah, I mean, the huge amount of vocabulary that came from French is the biggest thing mm-hmm. that would have been different. It was already losing its gender. It was already becoming all about syntax rather than mm-hmm. word ending. So that probably, I mean, it might have been, it was accelerated, but it would have, I'm sure, gone that direction anyway. But what would have been mainly different, so syntax wouldn't have changed all that much.
No. The changes that were happening in the syntax were already happening.
Yeah, yeah. And the contact with Latin and other those, you know, mm. those other languages would have continued to sort of have that effect that kind of, mm. you know, people would have still tried to write like Cicero sometimes in English, and that would have affected the way we use clauses and that kind of, you know, the amount of embedded clauses and relative clauses and dependent clauses in general that English uses now is a lot more than they did in the past. But I think that comes more out of classical attempts to write like classical writers yeah. than it does out of French
yeah.
specifically. And in French, it also comes out of trying to be like classical writers. So I think that probably still would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But the vocabulary, obviously, we would still have picked up Latin words, so, and we would continue to do so, but not in anything like the rate, right? Like many, many synonyms we have for things where we have a French version and an English version. We wouldn't have that French version. So, yeah, it would be the vocabulary.
Yeah.
Ivan points out that it's not just humans, of course, that we still gender, but animals where it's relevant, like lion and lioness, or
yeah.
mare and stallion, or whatever. That one's not, of course, endings. That's a simple, different word. But, yeah, but it's still natural gender in the sense that if we feel like there's actually a meaningful difference in the gender of and that matters, we'll use an ending to denote that, or at least did. You don't have stone and stonette, right? Because we don't care that the stone is feminine or masculine, because we do not think of stones as feminine or masculine. So yeah, maybe somewhat like modern Scots.
Yeah, that's a good comparison, actually, because modern Scots is not derived from English. Modern Scots comes from Old English, and it divided off very early.
Now, it still has a lot of French influence.
It does still have French influence.
But that's because of specific historic connections, not conquest, but strong historic connections between Scotland and France due to complicated anti-English sentiment mostly. That's why like Mary Queen of Scots and the French were very connected and things like that.
But Scots
but
does preserve
not nearly as much as English does.
Yeah. But Scots does preserve a bunch of Old English vocabulary mm-hmm. that has disappeared from English.
Right.
So yeah, looking at modern Scots is probably a really good place to see, get a bit of a glimpse at what it might be like a bit.
And just to be clear, I know you know that, but Scots, not Gaelic, which is separate, it's a Celtic language. So modern Scots is also not just Scots dialect of English, which there is also a Scottish dialect of English.
There's Scottish English, there's Scots, and there's Gaelic.
Yeah, those are three separate things, so mm-hmm. it's a little complicated. Are there books on language that you would suggest to read? This actually matches up with another question we had asked about what resources, well, I'm just trying to find the person who actually asked it. Yeah, Jacob Pikarski asked if we could share some of the tools that we found useful and trustworthy when we're asking about, like, is this word related to that word, for instance?
So in terms of reference sources, you know, the big one is, of course, the Oxford English Dictionary. So it's available online by subscription.
Yeah.
You have to pay, or many public libraries have access to it. Most university libraries have access to
most.
It.
Not ours.
It does still.
Oh, it does?
I fought and won that one. But,
they almost did.
So, you know, you can access that. That's the sort of prime one to look at. Another online one is the American Heritage Dictionary. So the link for that is ahdictionary.com. And it's particularly useful because it has an appendix with the Proto-Indo-European roots in it. And so if you really want to, you know, dig deep in etymology, that's a useful thing. And there is a book version of that appendix. This is, in fact, expanded from that American Heritage Dictionary appendix. So there's more in here than is on the in the online version, or the version that you get in an American Heritage Dictionary.
That's the American Heritage Dictionary of Indo-European Roots.
It's a
very, very basic title.
So for English etymology, for English, you know, for the Proto-Indo-European roots, for English words anyways, this is, you know, kind of the best place to turn. There are, of course, more complete dictionaries for Indo-European, but they're, you know, they're big and very technical. Mm-hmm. And, well, the standard one is written in German. So Pikorni is the still
Pikorni. Pikorni is that one. Two things. One, I think the original question was also partly about, like, when learning multiple languages, if you want to say, like, is this Spanish word related to that French word? Do you have a good way of doing that kind of work? Especially, I guess, within European languages, because that's, you know, we know much more about European languages than non-European languages. So
this is one that I picked up that does a good job of that. So it's Indo-European Cognate Dictionary by Fiona McPherson. And so what it has is it's got indexes of a whole bunch of different languages in the Indo-European family. And so you can look up, you know, whatever word you want in one language, and then it will refer you to what the Indo-European root is. And then when you look up the Indo-European root, it then gives you, grouped by language, all the words that come from that root.
So, oh, that's really cool.
So that does exactly what you're asking for. So it's a really, it's a good one for
the cross language.
Yeah.
For Indo-European language.
For Indo-European.
We don't have a lot of suggestions for your, you know, is Hungarian this related to Finnish that? That one you're on your own for. Sorry. Then, but I think Robert, I don't know what specifically you're looking for. Those are reference works. In terms of books on language, there's been a bunch coming out recently that you might want to find, like, friends and things.
Well, one in particular, we interviewed the author recently on the podcast. Paul Anthony Jones put out a book that covers, like, all the kind of basic questions that you might have about linguistics and language. And it is called, Why is this a question?
Why is this a question? And it's the question is about English you never thought to ask sort of idea. And Paul Anthony Jones is the guy who does Haggard Hawks on Twitter and elsewhere, if you know him. And so that's it goes into enough depth that if you do already know some basic stuff, you're still going to learn things. We learned things from it. But at the same time, it's written very much for non-specialists. So if you are just interested in language, but don't know that much about, you know, terminology and things, it's really good. So that definitely recommend.
Yeah, I would recommend that if you want a general, you know, book about language, and, you know, not specifically focusing on one particular area. If you want something general about language, that's an excellent starting place. So,
yeah, I mean, there's lots of other just books about language that are great. David Crystal has good books.
Yeah, anything by David Crystal.
There's a book that I was recently reminded of that's about very specifically about internet language, Because Internet by Gretchen McCullough is a favorite of ours. It's about sort of what the internet has and hasn't done to the English language and how communication on the internet is different than it is in other fora. There's works by, I'm just trying to think of people we've talked to recently about language. Oh, well, Grace Tierney has some books on etymology. She has a book, Words the Vikings Gave Us, Words the Sea Gave Us. She's working on more. So those are some good books. I don't know, some of the other sort of more textbooky ones, if you want to.
Well, if you want a book specifically about etymology, there's a book by Anatoly Lieberman called
called
Word Origins and How We Know Them, I think.
Okay,
is the title. And so it sort of explains, well, how do people do etymology? So it's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. And there's a recommendation in the chat.
Ockrent's book. Yeah.
Highly Irregular. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're also just about to do an interview with a book that's going to be coming out soon. We're going to do the interview with the author. The book is about to come out soon in April, a book called Like Literally Dude, which is with a sociolinguist about the kinds of things people live to, what we can learn, or I think the subtitle is something like The Good That Can Come From Bad English or something like that. And it's about the sorts of things that tend to be stigmatized as bad English and why they exist and where they come from. I haven't actually read past the introduction yet because we're interviewing her on Thursday, and I just got the PDF yesterday, so I can't tell you much more than that. But it looks good so far, and so keep your stay tuned. That will come The book will come out at the end of April, but our interview will come out in May. So if you're interested in that. Some more questions in the chat. One, it's more technical. What about the word child? Where it came from. So Scots is bairn, which is the Germanic word. A Germanic word.
Child is also Germanic. So
is it related to kind, in like kind to kind there? I don't know about that, but
top of my head I'm not.
Okay, he'll look that up while I see what else there is in the chat. Unicorn Danny, yeah. As Ivan says, Latin had three genders, and that's why basically all the Romance languages have some variety of genders. They've mostly simplified down to two, but not all of them. And that's the basic thing. You know, everything was, every single noun had to have a gender. There are a few common gender nouns and a few exceptions that work in strange ways, but every noun had a gender. Gender simply meant what kind of ending it took, what kind of system of ending. So Germanic languages also had that. Proto-Indo-European had at least three genders. Discussion about what the genders were. And so that's what you get. And some languages drop them and some of them don't. Yes, Arcanics, I agree entirely. It's a charming, sounds a little, I'm not sure charming sounds like the biggest compliment, but I do mean it that way. Like it's a well-written, interesting, amusing book. So, and it's an easy read. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So interestingly, child, we don't know where it comes from. It's in Old English, but there's no other cognate in any other Germanic language. We can sort of recreate what we think it would have looked like in Proto-Germanic, but there's no clear related word to it. So a bit of a mystery.
So good question.
So not related to kind.
Wood Perfect by Susie Dent. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Susie Dent's books are always fun. She has books a little older. Some of her books are, she has books about the, like, I'm not sure what it's called, but it's books about trade words, words that are specific to certain in-groups, especially certain professional groups, like the words that London cabbies use and the words that shipbuild, you know, the army uses and things like that. So she's fun. I mean, words about language are a big category. There's a lot of them are more sort of like, here's a list of, like, Paul Anthony Jones has a bunch of, here's a list of interesting words and where they come from and why they're interesting, or here's a list of just funny words. He specializes in weird, often obsolete words and that sound funny or are interesting. But there's also lots of words about, and then there's the kinds of books about like how language works and why it works the way it does. Yeah. Okay. So the other questions, if there are some questions. So that was tools. Oh, the other thing that I should just say is, if you go to our website, alliterative.net, there is a page of, I think it's called Sources and Credits, and on that there's a link to general linguistic sources, and if you go there, it has like all of the reference works that you've mentioned are on there. Is that one listed on there?
Maybe not that one.
You should add that one, because I think that's a new one. But it lists the general sources that Mark uses for the sort of etymological side most of the time. So there's a big long list, both of online and books and articles and things like that, that he uses on a regular basis. So that's almost a good place to start. All right, Arcanics 1971, you asked a question in a YouTube comment that just as a sort of discussion question, so I'm going to put it to Mark. You can only choose one area of linguistics to study or discuss for the rest of your life, and your choices are either morphology or semantics. Which would you choose and why?
I mean, probably semantics, just because it kind of goes on forever. Morphology can be interesting. It's funny because my opinions of these have changed over the years. When I was a grad student, probably the one I was least interested in was the phonology side. And yet now looking at sound changes is one of my most favorite areas of linguistics. So, you know, these things can change, but probably semantics. I mean, in fact, I've done way more with syntax than, you know, in terms of professional work than I have with any of these. I mean, that's really what my, you know, graduate work focused on mostly. And so, but I would say probably semantics. There's a lot of different ways to approach semantics and a lot of different, you know, kind of theoretical ways of thinking about it. So.
And your interests in cognitive linguistics would fit best with semantics in general. You know, interest in semantic fields and and while etymology is lots about sound changes and morphology, it's also, you know, you spend a lot of time on semantic changes and semantic developments, especially in the videos.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to answer the question because I'm not a linguist, so I don't feel I have to. And also, it would have to be semantics because I know it's a little bit morphology. So it's sort of a simple question for me. There was another question that we don't have an answer to, so I'm just going to quickly say it was from Trig. It was about ASL, and was Stoko really the first person to recognize ASL as a distinct language?
I mean, the only kind of answer that I can give is that, you know, it depends what you mean, you know, the first person to recognize this, because there was exact name of it, but there was a signed language used by indigenous people in North America that was not only useful, you know, for people who were hearing impaired, but was used as a lingua franca between people who spoke different languages but could use the same signed language. So obviously they had some sense that it was, you know, its own thing. And that must have been, you know, long before Indians were in North America. So,
yeah, but I mean, so that's the question was about ASL.
Specifically, I don't know.
In terms of, were there people before who recognized signed languages as signed languages? That's a different question. And really the short answer is neither of us know very much about sign languages, so we would have just Googled it. And no, we wouldn't have come up with anything better than you can get through Googling, sorry. Now, there's a question in the chat about whether either of us has ever been involved in a language maintenance or revival project. And again, short answer is no. I'm aware of and sort of know of people around us doing that. So we live in Northern Ontario, and the local Indigenous language is Anishinaabe here, and there is Anishinaabek language teaching going on at the university that I used to work at and that Mark still works at, though not as much teaching as they used to be because they fired that set of teachers. So, but I believe there is still some language teaching that's going on there. And that is, it's a maintenance, that language never disappeared, but it's not a revival, it's a language maintenance, but it is also, you know, an attempt to strengthen because, of course, of the intense efforts put in by the Canadian government to make the language disappear. So that is one that is going on around us. And for instance, we have a colleague who worked on an Anishinaabek dictionary that is very important for that kind of work. We did mean to have her on the podcast before our university imploded and she retired. And I'm not sure how easy it would be to do now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, don't worry, Louis. It wasn't only, or Louis, I'm sorry, I don't know which. It was not only the linguistics department. It was all of the humanities. And in fact, it wasn't the linguistics department. That didn't even exist already. It was
the entire modern languages department, gone.
Yeah, but it was also the Indigenous studies, all of the Indigenous studies programs, which is what it was taught under. That was canned, as well as classics, which is mine, which is why I lost my job, and women's studies, and
a whole slew of
religious studies, and philosophy, and what else? Oh, also math and physics, because we're an engineering school, so why would you need a math and a physics department? The physics department had recently produced a Nobel Prize winner the year before, or a Nobel Prize had been awarded to somebody who taught there. But, you know, anyway, not that's something we're a little bitter about or anything. Look up Laurentian University if you'd like to hear the whole sordid story. They declared insolvency and canned 110 full-time faculty and cut 69 programs. So anyway, it was fun. You'd think, I said at the time, oh, well, maybe this will mean that I have more time to devote to this project. And then we immediately ceased to put anything out. So turns out, no, looking for an entire new job and career takes up some time, both actual and emotional time. And that kind of derailed me a bit.
So. But in terms of revival and maintenance, we did do a podcast episode that focused on scripts, on alphabets, on the maintenance and revival of you know, endangered writing systems.
Mm-hmm. That was fairly recently. So if you're interested in that and you haven't heard that episode, I think it's three episodes ago, something like that, on endangered alphabets. And that was really interesting. So no, we haven't either of us worked specifically done that work. But of course, we know of and are connected to other people. We also just recently were on a panel, well, at Lincom, which this is in connection with. At Lincom, we were on a panel with someone who's done a podcast called Tongue Unbroken, which is about language in Alaska, Alaskan languages, Indigenous languages, and lots of different elements of the sort of political and linguistic and social world of Alaskan Indigenous languages. The last episode, which is the only one I managed to listen to so far, but is about the fight to get Indigenous languages of Alaska declared official languages of Alaska, which they won. But it's a really interesting sort of first-person narration with the host and two other people who were involved in getting getting the bill passed about the sort of process of doing it. And it was totally fascinating. So anyway, that's just, again, we're hoping maybe to have him on, I don't know, the podcast. We have so many people we want to interview on the podcast, and we only really have this ability to put out one episode a month, and we also want to do other things that aren't interviews. And so we just have this ever-growing list of people and not enough time to do it. If I had the money to pay somebody to edit them, we would just be interviewing someone every week, as far as I'm concerned, until we ran out of these fascinating people we know. But yeah, excuse me.
So yeah, so we haven't worked on revival or maintenance, but we're interested in the topic, and you know, we're always game to
pro it.
Yeah, and so yeah, we're always game to talk about it on the podcast with experts who do that work.
Yeah, because it's something that you can't just get into on a whim. You really have to be connected to communities who are doing it before you make any efforts. Right. One more question that we had from before, I will just go with. This one was exciting because it isn't, it's something that I did the answer to. I was going to say that I know about it. My answer is mostly going to be, I don't actually know about it. But it was from Tim Hammack, who's on Patreon, who said, I recently read that the Romans knew of Shiva and equated Shiva with Dionysus. I assume this happened before Constantine. So do we know if they knew of any of the other pantheon? Do they know, were there connections with the sort of farther east than Parthia? Basically, what from the far east did or did not influence the ancient world, linguistically or otherwise? And this is not something I know a lot about, but that connection between Shiva and Dionysus, as far as I can tell, it was a reasonably quick research. I didn't go really, really in depth to it. As far as I can tell, that connection was not made in the ancient world, or at least not by the sources we have. We have a few sources. So the obvious thing is Dionysus was said to have visited India. So in his myth, he was said to have visited and conquered India. So that's in the Greek, you know, early Greek sources we have. What they mean by India, what they mean by Dionysus visited it, it's all left sort of. All that means is he comes back with panthers and leopards in his retinue, and he's exotic, right? So, it used to be said, oh, that means that Dionysus comes from the east, and the Greeks always sort of talked about him as this foreign god. But in fact, we have his name in Linear B tablets from the Mycenaean period as clearly connected to making offerings. So he's clearly as old as any of the other Greek deities that we have evidence for. That doesn't mean he didn't come from the East originally, but I mean, as Aphrodite seems to have, but certainly he's not a newer or more recently introduced foreign god. That said, the connection between him and Shiva, which there is scholarly discussion of that, but it doesn't seem to have been done in the ancient world. And the there's one author in 1979 wrote this book, Shiva and Dionysus, in French, Alain Danielou. And he seems to be referred to all the time. So there's like, I found a website that sort of goes over the evidence for this connection. It's called dionysusandshiva.wordpress.com, and it has good citations. So there's lots of parallels. They both are associated with wild animals and spotted animals. They both are associated with the lingam or phallus. It's a prominent element of the worship of both deities, certain kinds of ecstatic and orgiastic celebrations, connections to fertility, other elements of their story that have connections. So it may well be that they're connected, but probably, if so, more from, you know, Indo-European and larger trends, or, you know, they're parallel, or maybe they're from the same source a long time ago. But that does not seem to have been recognized in the ancient world. We have one author in the ancient world in the Roman period, who's a Greek, who says that there was a connection between Dionysus and an Indian god of Nysa, because that's what Dionysus means. It means god of Nysa. Nysa was the name, in myth, was the name of the mountain that he was sheltered in as a baby. But that mountain is located in 100 different places. Like, every different place says, oh, this is Mount Nysa. Or says, but Mount Nysa always means it's always outside of wherever you are. So wherever you are, Mount Nysa is far away. And so at a certain point, it starts getting located in India. But that doesn't connect him to Shiva particularly. So there doesn't seem to be an ancient recognition of that particular connection. If there is a connection, it wasn't recognized in the ancient world. In terms of other, I also couldn't find any particular evidence that the Romans knew of other Hindu gods in the Hindu pantheon. But that's not to say they didn't, because there certainly was contact between the Indian world and the Indian subcontinent and the Roman world. And in fact, there had been contact, of course, in the Greek East between northern India and Pakistan. And Alexander had, you know, conquered that part of the Persian Empire and had contact. And there's this area that's known as Gandhar, which was a Greco-Bactrian and Greco-Parthian and Indo-Parthian series of kingdoms, where there's something called Greco-Buddhism, which is it's the place where the first images of the Buddha come from, the first time that the Buddha is represented sculpturally, because of the Greek tradition of representing gods sculpturally, which was not at that point an Indian tradition, I gather from the sources. So if they knew of Indian gods and pantheon, it would be Buddhist rather than Hindu, it seems, most likely, because most of the connections seem to have been, other connections seem to have been with Buddhist groups. There are various evidences of contact. We know that Augustus apparently received ambassadors from some kingdoms in northern India and also from Tamil areas of southern India. There's evidence that Claudius was in contact with the Sri Lankan court. And there's definite evidence, both historical and lots of archaeological evidence, that there was both direct and indirect trading between India and Rome. So direct, like Roman merchants actually sailing to Sri Lanka and to other places like that, and to other parts of India. Not always the parts that are closest, because it has to do with the wind and current, what was easiest to reach. So in fact, it was easier to reach southern India in some ways than it was to reach northern India, just because of things I don't understand about the ocean. But there was connection, and there seems, some people suggest that there were in fact groups of Buddhists living in Alexandria around the beginning of the Roman Empire. So if there was influence from India on a language, so I don't know of any particular linguistic influence on Latin. There may be, but I couldn't find anything. If there was cultural influence, probably Buddhism, not Hinduism. And there are arguments that the stories of the birth of the Buddha influenced the stories of the birth of Jesus. Now, that is a fairly controversial point, but it is not impossible because of these points of contact that, and Alexandria as one of the places where sort of early Christianity was forming its stories, certainly is a place that there could have been contact, because Alexandria was a big trading hub. So that's a lot of I'm not sure, but it is really interesting. I mean, there are caches of Roman coins that have been found in various places in India. There's Indian materials certainly that make it to Rome and well past Rome as well. Of course, pearls and silk and spices being the most important trade items. So that's everything I can say about that. And Louis, if you are interested in that, The Unbroken Tongue is the podcast. If you look that up, you'll be able to find the name of the person if you're interested in finding it more of that. All right. I think that was all of our previous questions that we were asked ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So are there any other questions or comments or discussion anybody else wants to contribute and chat about?
And again, apologies for not having done a live stream in so long. We quite enjoyed the last time we did one. We just never got around to doing one again. So,
and we meant to do one to celebrate, because we'd been marking sort of numbers of subscribers on the videos, and we hit 40,000, and we meant to do one for 40,000 and then didn't. So I guess this is also a celebration of hitting 40,000 subscribers. There's a lot of things we've been meaning to do and haven't in the last couple of years. And all I can do to excuse us is to point to the general state of the world and also to the specific transitions that we've been going through ourselves. It's been a up and down kind of last little while. I now have a 9-to-5 job, for instance, which is a whole new thing I have to figure out how to deal with, which I'm sure is not does not make anybody else who has a 9-to-5 job feel very sorry for me, but just a different rhythm.
With Jackson Crawford. Yeah, that would be fun. That would definitely be fun.
We've talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you also talked about having him on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that would probably be the way to, if we did that, then once we made that connection, we could.
Yep.
Yeah. We've been a little reluctant to try to do, given how terribly we've been doing it, keeping up with our own videos, we've been reluctant to propose collabs because we don't want to, you know, disappoint somebody else by not following through. So we sort of wanted to be a little more back on a level, getting things done better, basically. We wanted to be doing, being more productive before we collabed. But yeah, so sure. Well, I'll make sure he's on our list. We've got the next 3 months sorted. But after that, it's open. I'm taking notes. Thanks, Louis. So Seymour cut the bread with a knife and Seymour used the knife to cut the bread. Are we familiar with that debate? I don't know the debate. I mean, is it between which of those is clearer? I mean, those are just two ways of saying the same thing. So I don't think I know the specific debate you're referencing. Hmm. Thanks, Organics. I really appreciate you being hanging here and hanging out. Have fun at playing chess. Yeah, we will probably be ending fairly soon just because I am losing my ability to speak. And we've been going for more than an hour. But we don't want to head out before people are done. I don't know if anyone here who's still here was at Lingcom or went to any of that. I don't know if that's something that other people, I mean, you have to be doing linguistics communication for it to be interesting. But if there was anyone who was there, and I hope you enjoyed it, we had a really good time hanging out with other linguistics communicators and finding out what sorts of things people are trying to do and in what venues and using what platforms and with what purposes. Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, whether the underlying form
are
the same. I mean, you know, I guess that comes down to a kind of Chomsky question, you know, how much of language is sort of underlying structures and how much of it, I'm more on the behavioralist side of things. And I think even Chomsky himself is not so committed to, you know, deep structures and categories anymore either. So it's just the hardline Chomsky, or more hardline than Chomsky himself, who would, you know, see these things as the same structure, I guess.
Well, because, I mean, they're both, they're, the question is, both of them are doing an ablative of means or a dative of means, mm-hmm. or whatever, like they're doing, the knife is the means, mm-hmm. by which the thing is done. Doesn't matter whether you say, but technically Seymour cut the bread with the knife, you've got what would be in Latin an ablative. I mean, that doesn't mean it is an ablative in English, but it's sort of an ablative use. Whereas, Seymour used the knife to cut the bread. You've got technically it's an accusative, right? He used the knife, and mm-hmm. But they're both doing the same thing in the sentence. So the end result is that the knife is the means by which the thing is done. So it doesn't matter if it's an ablative of means or an accusative in a verbal phrase. Are they really equivalent or not as a structure? And that sounds like the sort of thing that true linguists discuss, and I don't. So I'll leave it to Mark right now. So I think those are the kinds of things that they're like the numbers of angels that can dance on the head of a pin that can be entertaining, but don't necessarily get you much further in your understanding. Do you miss modal particles in English?
I mean, we still have modals. By modal particles, what are you specifically referring to?
Can't miss them if you never had them. I know of modal particles. If it's the same thing as they're thinking of, I know of them in Greek.
Greek
is where they have particles at the with a lot of and that is what they are.
They're the express modality.
And boy, oh boy. I mean, well, I was gonna say I don't miss them because they're so annoying, but that's actually probably not true.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, okay. So, yeah, so that's basically the same thing.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I mean, we've got all kinds of you know, little ways, different language. So I guess it depends on, you know, it is that question, what is the connection between what you see on the surface level and what you see going on below the surface? You know, English has lots of ways to
express modality.
You know, we don't use the same particles in the way that, that German does.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it is true that a certain number of the ways that English does it are disfavored in standard English,
yeah.
So that there's a lot of the mm-hmm. modality that we're actually quite good at expressing in spoken English and in dialects of English that aren't really necessarily that dialectal, but dialectical? No, that's a word in philosophy. I don't know. I'm losing my ability to...
Dialect,
I'm losing my ability to language here. So, you know, like, for instance, mm-hmm. which is one of those things we use to express certain kinds of modality all the time, but is not considered, or, you know,
yeah. So, and I think those are used functionally like particles, really.
Because they obviously don't have the lexical mm-hmm. meaning that they theoretically would. Yeah. But that's what I mean, but they're, you know, mm-hmm. they're dispreferred in
formal writing,
but also even informal speech, to the extent that people, you know, that this book that's coming out that we're going to be interviewing her about is all about people's dislike of such things, and other things like non-standard verb formations, like I'm a be doing or something, you know, I'm gonna do something means something different than I'm going to or whatever, right? Like there's a lot of like the Irish, he's after coming to dinner. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't mean the same as he is coming to dinner. Those are two different things, but one of those is, you know, a dialect. But really what it is doing is expressing a certain kind of modality. So I think there's a lot of what are seen as informal in English. And what I don't know, because I don't know German well enough, is to what extent things like doch und ja und eben and stuff like that are verbal, but not, you know, discouraged in formal written, or to what extent they are considered part of formal language. So for instance, in Greek, ancient Greek, which is what I know it from, those particles are absolutely common in formal, both poetic and prosaic sources. So it is not at all seen as a part of spoken language that shouldn't be in your written language. Like they're, it's filled with them, all the ands and the ands. And like, in fact, they're required. They're to a certain degree, if you're going to use a subjunctive or optative, you have to use the on particle or whatever. So there's these various things that are absolutely not discouraged. Whereas in English, I think a lot of them are these days. Mm-hmm. And I think that might be because Latin doesn't have that many of them, mm-hmm. of those kind of ones, or at least written Latin. Goodness knows what there was spoken. In spoken language, Latin. But in written Latin, you don't have the same types of particles that Greek does. Therefore, if we have it in English, it must be wrong, right? The old story of English grammar. Anyway, that's just not off the top of my head. I don't know anything but the formal study that I have definitely seen that.
A lot of that work gets done by people working on pragmatics and discourse analysis,
yeah.
because it is, you know, a lot more common to do that sort of thing in spoken language, English. So, you know, that's where you do find those sorts of discussions. And certainly in Old English, there were what to my mind were, you know, a lot of, if you call them pleonasms, but like seeming overuse of, you know, little words that you don't strictly speaking need to have there for the meaning of, you know, the strict sense of the sentence. But you find them used a lot in certain kinds of narrative texts. And so my theory is that they're performing, you know, discourse functions.
Right. Not the pragmatic, yeah.
And giving you, yeah, modal, like high, you know, foregrounding certain materials, certain parts of the, you know, the text of the discourse, and, you know, doing those sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe it's about time for us to wrap up, unless there's any last questions. I just want to say thank you to everybody for dropping by. We really appreciate it. We also appreciate your interest in the work and the videos in general. Again, we apologize for how long it's taken us to get out more of them. We are working on it. I promise it is a continued thing. And don't worry, the little ones are not stopping us from doing the long ones. Because I always feel like some people might be feeling that. They are in parallel. But We are working on stuff. I don't think Mark is drawing out the current one so that he has more excuses to drink the cocktail that he's writing about, but it is a small possibility that that's what's going on. So I will make sure to keep an eye on him. But we really do are very, very grateful for your interest and your presence here. And we hope to keep producing more material and nerding out about language and other related things.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, everyone.
And we'll see you on the YouTubes. Thanks, Ivan.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.